Life's big decisions aren't always easy, but you don't have to figure them out alone. Psychic Source connects you with trusted psychics who offer real insight, not just predictions. Whether it's love, career, or life's big questions, you'll get honest, judgment-free guidance in a private safe space, anytime, 24/7. And if your reading doesn't feel right, it's free. Take control of your future. Get a reading for just 83 cents per minute, plus 3 minutes free. Visit PsychicSource.com and use promo code HELLO25 to get started. Psychic Source, insight when you need it most.
Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Dede Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. Across the country, Democratic leaders and voters are beginning to push back against Trump's upheaval of government, Elon Musk's chaotic meddling, and the fallout from the administration's gutting of the federal bureaucracy. And not a moment too soon, I can say. Seeing the damage inflicted by Trump 2.0, some are cautiously optimistic that a few key state races could serve as a crucial odd-year referendum, with major implications for voters, donors, and even Republican politicians who may reconsider their allegiances after significant MAGA defeats. Speaking of cautious optimism, joining us today is our cautiously optimistic national affairs correspondent, John Nichols, who in our July issue turned his focus to two potential bellwethers, Virginia and New Jersey. He spoke with politicians, strategists, and activists to understand what's at stake this fall and who might be best positioned to deliver a winning message. We'll delve into some questions pivotal to this moment. Who's leading the charge? What will resonate with voters who've drifted right? How is their messaging more progressive and robust than earlier iterations of the resistance? And what might success look like for the party in the crucial years ahead? John, welcome to the Nation Podcast.
Don, it's great to be with you. And I will accept the cautiously optimistic description in this case, primarily because I've spent a lot of time out in the country, and frankly, there is a lot more optimism out in America than there is in D.C.
And in New York, probably. John, this is not your first rodeo or mine, and yet neither of us would ever call Virginia or New Jersey particularly battleground states. So explain to our listeners why you turned your focus to those two states.
Well, there's the practical reality that in the United States, we have two states which hold odd year gubernatorial races in the year immediately after a new president takes office. That's New Jersey and Virginia. This is a long tradition. And so we always look at them, you know, with an interest in getting some measure. You're right that in recent decades, New Jersey and Virginia have been considered more Democratic states because they've tended to vote Democratic in presidential races. But I'll remind you that it wasn't many years ago that New Jersey had Republican Governor Chris Christie. And currently, Virginia has a Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin. And so these are states where Republicans can win. More importantly, these are states where in 2024, when Joe Biden's campaign suddenly got very weak after that debate, you started to see polling that showed there were a lot of people who were prepared to vote even for Donald Trump. And in both of these states, Trump did better, significantly better, in 2024 than he did in 2020. So these are states that are worth looking at because of a volatility that is out there, I think, everywhere in America, including these places.
And talk a little bit about the background in New Jersey, because I think it may surprise people who haven't been paying close attention and who have mercifully forgotten the Christie era.
Well, yeah, there's a lot to try and forget, although Christie is now a Trump critic, outspoken in many cases.
Well, I mean, you know, and there was Tom Keene, I mean, and Christy Whitman. I mean, you know, New Jersey had Republican governors, but we still think of it, particularly us narrow-minded New Yorkers, as an appendage of the metropolis. So why is it fertile territory for Republicans? And what difference does having Trump having a country club in the state make?
Well, he's there a lot, so he's heard frequently and able to kind of keep his hand a little bit on the Republican Party in New Jersey. So all their potential candidates reach out to him and want his imprimatur. But this is the important thing to understand. In 2021, when Virginia went to the Republicans, and 2021 saw a big shift to the Republicans in Virginia. They won the governor's office, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. And they really narrowed the margins in the legislature. And so there was a very good year for Republicans in 2021 in Virginia. In New Jersey, the Democrats narrowly held on with their current governor, Governor Murphy. But what's significant about it is that the Democrat candidate for governor in New Jersey in 2021 only won by a couple points. The Republican almost took New Jersey 4 years ago. So what that tells you is that who turns out matters, of course, and also the volatility of the state is much more present than I think a lot of our national pundits tend to notice. This is a, Don, I would just suggest to you, this is a challenge in our politics generally. People in Washington and some TV studios in New York are obsessed with putting states into their compartment and saying, okay, this is who you are. You'll never be anything different.
Right.
And so forever, Iowa and Ohio were swing states. Then in 2016, Trump won both those states by a reasonable margin. He won them again in 2020, 2024. Now, no one can imagine that Iowa or Ohio could ever be anything but Republican red states. That's wrong. They could be, and we might in 2026 see some surprises out of both of them. Similarly, in states that pundits and political watchers want to compartmentalize as very blue states, like Virginia and New Jersey, there's a lot of evidence that they are not nearly so deep blue, so deeply Democratic as the pundits imagine.
Well, and so essentially you're saying these are states that are in play.
At least to some extent. And both sides see it as such.
Right. And that means they've got their game on in both these states. But let's go back a bit to Youngkin. And because when he won in Virginia, I remember that was read nationally as a repudiation of a lot of things that Democrats thought were winning issues for us. So do you want to talk a little bit about what led to Youngkin's victory?
Sure. And this is when you cover politics, I think you have to recognize that there are always more factors than just the simple one. Right, of maybe Democrats in Washington not doing a good job or doing a good job or whatever. One of the realities in Virginia in 2021 was that their nominee for governor, Terry McAuliffe, ran a pretty rotten campaign. It didn't work well. The party was divided. There was a primary. There was a lot of push and pull. And I think that it's fair to say that the Democratic Party was off message in state. Beyond that, though, you had a lot of push and pull in D.C. It was at a time when Biden was trying to advance a lot of his agenda and, frankly, not doing all that well. Eventually, he got a lot of the things that he wanted, but there were points in that fall of 2021 where Washington looked pretty chaotic and pretty messy. If you'll recall, and maybe you'll want to forget this, but, Biden had to deal with Democratic senators, Sinema and Manchin, who weren't giving him what he needed. There was pushes and pulls. It just didn't look very well organized. And I think that Youngkin and the Virginia Republicans pointed to that and said, there's a mess in D.C., and whether you would agree with that or not doesn't matter. And then also that there's a mess in the state. The state had been governed by Democrats for quite a long time. The message that Youngkin presented was, especially as regards
schools.
Education schools. Issues. Yeah. That things just weren't going the way they should. In many ways, Youngkin kind of anticipated some of the anti-DEI stuff that we've seen and some of the other messaging related to that. And he pulled off a victory. That's just the reality. And we should understand that, again, in New Jersey, it was very, very close. You could have, aside from, sort of a Democratic lucky break in New Jersey, you could have had two states go, if that had happened, I think the message for Biden would have been doubly devastating.
Right. Well, it's interesting because both of these elections are in November.
Yep.
But in Virginia, they've already got their candidate. Mm-hmm. So let's start with Virginia because that's going to be a little bit simpler. So yep. who's going to be the Democratic standard bearer in Virginia, and what's her background?
U.S. Rep. Abigail Spanberger, who is who has been around for a bit. She's a U.S. rep from Virginia. She won a couple of tough races along the way, and that kind of made her a star. She comes from a national security background, which seems to be, interestingly enough, a model that Democrats are developing around the country. They have a lot of people.
Are they still developing that model? Because I thought that was the Clinton ideal candidate, you know, somebody who can't be bullied on national security, but who's probably not very progressive on a lot of other issues either. Or am I being unfair to Abigail Spanberger?
Well, I think certainly if in the strategies of the National Democratic Party, you're being very fair. And they did do a lot of this. There were two kind of candidates that they liked: self-financing millionaires and people, especially women, who had come out of national security backgrounds. In Spanberger's case, she is certainly not a leftist. She's no big progressive, but she's recognized the kind of dynamics of the year. And as such, she is campaigning quite aggressively against Trump and frankly against a lot of the Republican agenda in Virginia. She's not perfect. In fact, there are issues that I find very troubling. She's not a supporter, an active supporter of overturning Virginia's right to work law, which is anti-labor. You know, kind of most southern states and even some northern states now have these anti-labor right to work laws. They ought to be overturned. They shouldn't be on the books.
Has that cost her union support in this campaign?
Doesn't look like it. Well, I think, remember, this has been a long-term reality in Virginia. And while I think there are many, many Virginia union activists and others who will tell you that they want to overturn that law, that it should be overturned, and that Spanberger should be on the other side of the issue, that she should be aggressively calling for overturning it, there's no question of that. I heard that from people. By the same token, they look at the Republicans, and the Republicans have such a record of being militantly anti-labor that on balance, I think there is a sense of something I've seen develop in a lot of states, especially southern and interior western states, where the union movement knows what it wants and looks for ways to get it. And at Frank in Virginia, they've made a lot of advances in this regard. They still don't want to set up a circumstance where they're dealing with Republicans who will block them on everything.
Right. Okay. So there's a pragmatic factor at work here. And
yep.
And do you want to say a little bit about why support for Spanberger and how it coalesced so early? I mean,
yep.
No primaries.
Look, Virginia's had a lot of primaries in going back to the 60s, and they have often been left-right struggles. The recent years have seen Democratic primaries for governor and for other posts, and there are some down-ballot primaries this year. So if we understand it in that context, what Spanberger has accomplished is pretty significant. And what I would suggest to you is that a lot of this has to do with things beyond Virginia, and that is that Virginia, the northern part of Virginia, is suburban Washington. And the people who live in that part of Virginia have been going through, you know, an existential crisis since Trump took office. I remember you talk about, you know, where the impact of Trump and Musk is really felt. It's a lot in Northern Virginia. This is a place where ripping up federal agencies, laying off federal workers, targeting all sorts of programs that were historically thought of as, I think, very secure. That has a real impact. And so I think that in a lot of the areas where you have a lot of progressive Democrats in Virginia, there was a sense, oh, we've got to get this together pretty quick because we can't afford to lose it this year. And I think that you saw a coalescing around a candidate who started early, has campaigned hard, has gone to every corner of the state, and frankly has, despite her own centrist background, has embraced a lot of the strong anti-Trump message. And really highlighted that when going out to, you know, county parties and folks across the state. So the bottom line, I think, to go back to is that Virginia is not that different than a lot of other places I'm seeing around the country. Even though there will be many Democratic primaries, and there's a big one in New Jersey, there are a lot of places where folks are trying to figure out how to, you know, get as united as they can, as early as they can, around potentially, I guess for them, hopefully strong candidates who they think can you know, kind of run a coherent campaign from early on through November.
So to the extent that Virginia is nationalizing its race, mm-hmm. which it sounds like they're doing, and she's not running against passing the PRO Act or reversing Virginia's right to work clause, what are Spanberger's issues? What is she running on?
A lot of messaging on the issues that frankly we're hearing, you know, quite a bit about in this cycle. Medicaid and the threats to it, those are big deals. Education funding, the assault on federal employees. Remember, right. Northern Virginia has a lot of federal employees. But it really is, in many ways, Don, you're right. It's a nationalized campaign. This is a campaign that says that Donald Trump and Republicans in Washington pose a real threat to Virginia. And having a Democratic governor who knows how to push back and fight against them, Democratic legislature as well, attorney general, lieutenant governor, that's a big deal. And that's a pretty resonant message. She's also put a lot of energy into education issues and healthcare issues. Now, the healthcare issues especially intersect with the threats to Medicaid, the threats to ultimately Medicare and Social Security. So I do think that while I'm sure the Virginia Democrats would want to tell you that they're not just nationalized, I think an awfully lot of the coherence and the messaging of their campaign at this point, which has gone pretty well, is an extension of this sort of nationalization of our politics.
So this is a very high stakes race in that sense. And, you know, you've done a brilliant job in the magazine of laying out exactly why it's a high stakes race, that if the Democrats win, it means hope has been kept alive for at least blocking some of Trump's initiatives, if not rolling them back. But I'm wondering, you know, and if they don't win, that's scary too, because here it is. They've coalesced around a candidate. They've got coherent messaging. They've got a pool of traumatized federal workers to appeal to. So you would think that's pretty favorable terrain. And then there's another factor, which brings me to a state that I know you hate to talk about, Wisconsin. And that is the influence of Elon Musk. Do you think his departure from the government is going to help the Republicans, or do you think that the Democrats can still use him as a wedge?
Well, we have very rapidly evolving politics, Don, as you well know. In fact, you probably better than anybody. And everything about our politics is sped up. So at this point, there is no question Elon Musk is still a huge scorching liability for the Republicans.
And remind our listeners about how that was recently tested in a certain Midwestern state.
Well, I don't really like to talk about Wisconsin, but I guess, no, it's my home state. I love talking about it. And Wisconsin has had an ongoing multi-year battle for control of its state Supreme Court between the left and the right. Democrats lining up on one side, Republicans on the other, even though it's a technically nonpartisan race. This spring, we had a race for an open seat on the Supreme Court. Whoever won the seat would tip the court either to the left or to the right. Donald Trump came in very early and endorsed a former Republican attorney general for the court seat. And then Musk came in massively. And there's a lot of, you know, different arguments about why Musk came in so big. But the bottom line is he spent at least $25 million of his own money, probably substantially more, via political action committees to support the conservative candidate and attack the liberal candidate. And then he flew in at the end of the campaign, literally distributing million-dollar checks to people who were active, you know, politically around the campaign, and putting on a cheese head and bouncing around on the stage in Green Bay, Wisconsin. It was one of the most jaw-dropping performances in modern American politics. And I can tell you, I mean, I was doing an MSNBC hit on the Wisconsin race that day, and they went to interviews in a parking lot of, I think it was in West Allis, Wisconsin, or some Milwaukee suburb, and they were interviewing people who were coming to vote and saying, well, why are you out to vote today? People were saying, oh, I want to make sure that I send a message to Elon Musk, you know, to like take the Packer hat off, you know? And so he really, he misread the state massively. And so you got two signals. Number one, Musk is actually politically harmful, right? When he shows up, when he's identified, that's harmful. Two, his money is not as powerful as I think a lot of people thought. So that I think, you know, Musk is now out of the White House, supposedly, we'll see, and picking on Trump, even on some issues. But I think you can directly trace the decline in Musk's influence to that Wisconsin result, because I think Trump doesn't like losing, and he doesn't like the ridicule that sort of attended to Musk in that race. So let's put that in one box, but let's never forget that Musk still has a lot of money. He has suggested he may not spend as much, but we don't know that. And in the Republican Party, they've got plenty of billionaires. They've got plenty ability to raise a lot of money. And that money will, this fall, focus on Virginia, on New Jersey, especially in New Jersey on the governor's race, and on cities around the country where mayors are being elected, perhaps even New York City, if, you know, some, you know, confluence of events occurs. Bottom line is that money in politics is a big deal. Republicans have gotten as far as they have, at least in part, because of their ability to marshal a lot of money in, you know, very big races. So,
yeah, no, I mean, I asked about Wisconsin, first of all, because I love hearing you talk about Wisconsin. It's a state that I'm not from, but that I love to visit. But also because the pool of federal workers doesn't just mean you have a lot of federal workers. It means you have a lot of people who got emails from Elon Musk saying, quit now and you can work till September. And then they got more emails from Elon Musk saying, what are the five things you did today to this week to justify your federal paycheck? So, you know, he's probably more toxic in Northern Virginia and Maryland than in any other states in the country. I mean, Wisconsin is a longer way away from that kind of Doge chaos than Virginia. So, you know, that's an auspicious omen. But as you point out, money always matters in politics, and the Republicans always have a money advantage. Are we seeing that yet in Virginia, or is that just something we're looking out for?
Well, no, there's money flowing around in Virginia. There's simply no question of that. And it's a pretty significant amount of money. I think that both sides are going to have a lot. In doing the piece for The Nation, I interviewed a lot of folks who watch this stuff in different ways and in relatively sophisticated ways. One of the people that I interviewed was Ben Wickler, who's the longtime chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party. He's stepping down this year. He also sought to become DNC chair. That didn't happen. I also interviewed the guy who beat him, Ken Martin. And one of the things that they both said that was very, very interesting is that, yes, the Republican money is real and it's big. There's no question. In fact, sometimes it comes in bigger chunks than we've seen before. But there's something very alive out there in America among grassroots progressives and Democrats, and that is a genuine engagement with these odd year elections, with political contests wherever they appear. And as a result, as Wickler said, the grassroots money, the small contributions, those, you know, sorts of contributions that Bernie Sanders relied on when he ran for president, are supercharged this year. They're coming in big, big numbers. And what that means is that there is a likelihood, not a certainty, but a likelihood that money will be relatively equalized. It may come from different sources. And remember, Democrats have a few of their own billionaires. But it may come from different sources. But at the end of the day, I think you're going to see very high spending, big money campaigns. The sources may be different, but the reality is the same. Lots of TV ads, etc.
So no bake sales for Spanberger, but...
I don't think so.
What do we know about the opposition in Virginia?
About the Democrat or the Republican candidate for governor of Virginia? Yeah, I mean, this is the interesting thing. So the Republicans have a pretty strong candidate in Virginia. It's the lieutenant governor, and it's Winsome Earle Sears. And she is a black woman from a Caribbean background who has, you know, she won the lieutenant governor's job 4 years ago, and that's a tough task. It's a significant one. So she's got political skills, and she is running as a continuation of the Youngkin governorship, which it was a controversial governorship, but some people obviously, you know, aligned with. She's very socially conservative, and that is probably going to end up being a real burden for her politically, because Virginia has shown itself to be increasingly a very pro-choice state and a state that's supportive of LGBTQ rights. And so the template that Republicans have tried to use in states across the country in recent cycles has been one that particularly tries to demagogue on transgender issues and things of that nature. I think there's a chance you'll see that in Virginia, but there's mounting evidence from Wisconsin and other places that doesn't get much traction at this point, not nearly so much as I think a lot of people imagined. And so if she runs a socially conservative campaign, I think she's going to run into a real challenge there. If she tries to run to the center, which I think you'll see some of, that also becomes challenging because, you know, again, she is going to be the candidate of Donald Trump's party. And even if she brings a more compelling story to the race than maybe another Republican, I think at the end of the day, we have such nationalized politics. In fact, I've been playing with the line that, you know, the era of Tip O'Neill is over. Now all politics is national and instead of local. And so I think that while the Republicans have a solid candidate, they are facing many challenges as regards the ideology of the party and the ideology of the candidate. There's also a little bit of chaos as regards the Republican ticket.
I didn't want to let you go without letting our listeners enjoy the contretemps over the fact that the socially conservative Republican gubernatorial nominee has a running mate who is part of a sex scandal because he's a gay man.
Well, yeah, and the whole thing is a mess, and we don't have enough time to go into it all. But let's just say that the two candidates on the Republican ticket don't get along. And to the point, they don't get along ideologically, they don't get along personally, and there's a, you know, there's kind of a push and pull between them that is, I think, has distracted from their attempt to put together a coherent campaign. And the flip of it is that on the Democratic side, there is a primary for lieutenant governor, and there's competition down ballot on the Democratic side. Not everybody agrees, but because it is this nationalization of it, you don't hear the Democrats really picking at each other or arguing with each other too much. And if I can throw one more thing into the mix, yes, you have this social issues difference on the Republican side. We are also seeing an emerging big difference on the Republican side about much of Trump's agenda. And, you know, do you back, you know, efforts to actually downsize, cut Medicaid and things like that? And in Virginia, among the Republicans, their congressional delegation, there's even some disagreements and stuff like that. So in an interesting sense, Republican chaos has become, you know, a real issue in Virginia, and one that probably benefits Democrats, at least to some extent.
Now, let us shift our attention to a slightly less orderly state to the east. I gather they order these things differently in New Jersey, John. What are the Democrats in New Jersey doing, and why does that race matter just as much, if not more?
Well, first and foremost, the New Jersey race matters just as much, if not more. In fact, if the Democrats lost in New Jersey, that would be a huge blow. There's simply no question of that. And New Jersey has had a pattern of relatively close gubernatorial races. And not always, but in 2021 for sure. And so as a result, New Jersey is a very big deal, and it's being under-examined. And the fact of the matter is, both parties have primaries going on right now. And this podcast will be done before they finish their primaries, but some people may listen to this after the primaries are finished. And so we could go through all the candidates on both sides. But the bottom line is this. The Republican nominee in New Jersey will almost certainly be a candidate who is close to sympathetic to Donald Trump. The Democratic candidate will be somebody who's highly critical of Donald Trump. And so in many ways, the New Jersey race, to my mind, is going to become an even clearer kind of, you know, like
referendum,
really
right?
Clear referendum on Trump. And Trump knows that. Remember, Donald Trump spends a good portion of his summer in New Jersey and at his Bedminster Country Club. And if we understand it in that context, this is a state that he pays close attention to. I've written about Trump for a very long time. I will tell you, there, I have many criticisms of the guy, but I will never criticize him for failing to monitor media. He watches politics around the country very, very closely, and he probably watches it in New Jersey as closely as any place. And so he has endorsed a candidate in the primary, and that candidate is the guy who ran in 2021, Jack Citarelli. And I think that that's likely to be the nominee, but this is the important thing to understand. Whoever it is, Trump's going to try and play there. He's going to try and win. And that will mean some money will come in, I'm sure of that. Now, on the flip side, on the Democratic side, there is great evidence that all of the candidates for the Democratic nomination intend to run against Trump. And in fact, you should see their ads. Their ads sort of compete with one another to suggest who would be the most anti-Trump candidate. And that may change a little after the primary. But the bottom line is that, you know, you're going to have something that's a very, very clear referendum on Trump and Trumpism in a state that just 4 years ago had a, you know, 2 or 3 point finish as regards their governor's race, and where Trump did run better in 2024 than in the past. So I think New Jersey is a big deal.
And there is the potential for history to be made in New Jersey, you know, with Ross Baraka's candidacy.
Yes. Yeah, Ross Baraka, you want to sum up the Trump factor in this thing. Here we have the mayor of, you know, a major, biggest city, Newark, running for governor as someone who was arrested by Trump's, you know, ICE agents, you know, when he tried to visit a detention facility. And in a very high profile, very bizarre and, you know, abusive situation. And so, obviously, he is running, Ross Baraka, a very, I think, very smart, very clearly defined campaign talking about the dangers of Donald Trump and from a personal standpoint. Now, he's not leading the race at this point. Mikey Sherrill, the congresswoman, is ahead, and there's a decent chance that that she could win. But there are other candidates, too. The mayor of Jersey City, current former legislators, union leaders. It's a crowded field.
Are they sniping at each other?
Yeah, a little bit.
Are they being...
No, they're sniping a bit. It's New Jersey, my friend. And so, yeah, they are basically suggesting that one or the other would do better, you know, be the strongest candidate in November, because, of course, there is this desire to win, which is very omnipotent, very present in all of these races around the country. And so, yeah, there is some sniping, and there are some candidates who are saying, yes, running against Trump is good, but remember, you also have to have a very clear agenda and a progressive agenda, frankly. Some of the more progressive candidates have been saying, be careful not to hang the whole thing on Trump, that you have to also have, you know, some messaging there. And I think that has resonated a good deal. You're hearing the candidates talk about how they want to separate themselves a little bit from Governor Murphy, the incumbent, while at the same time suggest that they would carry on some of the more popular things that he's done. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of sniping, but nothing. It hasn't, at this late stage, developed to a level that I think it would be particularly destructive. And my sense is that once the primary is held, once the nominee is chosen in mid-June, then you're going to have, I think, a pretty united party.
And also, you know, with Mikey Sherrill leading, the possibility of two women candidates.
Yeah. And two candidates, two women who came out of backgrounds, you know, in national security and the military, who ran for seats in Congress at a critical stage. And so you do see, you know, some similarities there. But frankly, there are differences as well. And I think the dynamics of these two states are distinct. Virginia has a certain type of politics that's developed over a very long time. New Jersey's politics has often been rooted in, you know, much stronger county parties, political organizations, and things of that nature. And I think it's always very important for the New Jersey Democratic Party to be united. And so that will be a critical test after the primary. If they do unite, then there's the final factor with New Jersey that I bring into everything I write about, you know, campaigns. I'm always looking at, you know, how campaigns operate in a particular state. New Jersey has a unique phenomenon, and that is that their TV advertising has to appear on TV stations from outside the state. Right. So it's New York TV and Philadelphia.
And Philadelphia, yeah. They're two very expensive markets, too.
Yeah, two of the most expensive markets in the country. That just booms up the price of the campaign at a dramatic level. It also kind of alters the nature of how the campaign is covered because, you know, if it's in the news, is it at the top of the news or is it down the way? How is it covered and things like that? I had a conversation in working on the piece with former Governor Jim McGreevy. And it was really interesting because he talked about when he was governor not that long ago, you know, a decade or so ago. And he said at that time, you know, you went to a stack of newspapers to see, you know, what they were saying about what had happened in the legislature, what they were saying about campaigns and stuff like that. And he ticked off how many of those newspapers are either dramatically diminished in some cases,
dead.
Don't even publish. Yeah. And so New Jersey politics, I think, is more volatile and unstable at this point than in the past. And so that's going to be a factor here, and one that, frankly, Democrats, whoever the Democratic nominee is going to have to work very, very hard to maneuver around and to be on top of.
So here's an interesting trivial point for you, John. Until Tony Kushner came along and pushed him out of the slot, Jim McGreevy was the most famous member of my graduating class.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that is very interesting. And here, can I give you an interesting fact?
Of course.
He's running for mayor of Jersey City.
Yeah, no, I know.
And he's a very viable contender.
He's an efficient fundraiser. I've already gotten the appeals.
Yeah, there's some always controversy around fundraising and stuff like that. But he is running. I found him to be an interesting guy to talk to because he had a lot of controversy around his own governorship, but he's got this deep perspective on New Jersey. And one of the things, and we're talking about kind of behind the scenes at the magazine, and one of the things that when I report on a particular state, I do try to find people who've been there for a long time, right? Who've kind of seen it evolve, but are still very involved, you know? Now, I don't want somebody just reflecting on the past. I want people who can talk to me about the evolution, about the changes in the state. And he was very useful in that regard. There are a couple of people I spoke with in Virginia. One of the most fascinating people as regards Virginia is an old fellow named Fergie Reed, who's 100 years old, and was the pioneering black state legislator back in the 60s. He is still at it along with his son.
His son is very active.
Yeah, and they're working to recruit candidates for the legislature. And I find that in talking to people who have history and also are currently active, that is very useful to get a perspective on, you know, what's still as it always was and what is changing. And the fact is that all of our states are changing very rapidly, and the results from Virginia and New Jersey are going to give us a lot of evidence about, you know, what changes have occurred, all the dynamics of those states. And they will, Don, I don't think there's any question, they will tell us a great deal. If we look at it with the nuance and some of the perspective we've, I hope, brought into this conversation, they will tell us a great deal about where America is at on the cusp of the 2026 midterm elections, which are frankly going to be, I'm going to argue, and I know people always say this, the most important
elections in our lifetime.
Well
that's the most important midterms. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm with you on that, John, and grateful as always. I think this is a great place to stop. You've done a brilliant job of outlining two very high stakes elections for political junkies or anybody who just has a thirst for a great story. in the July issue of The Nation, John's piece on Virginia and New Jersey. Riveting reading. Thank you for coming to The Nation podcast.
Thanks for having me, Don. It's a total pleasure.
Great to talk, John.